And welcome to the Rick House. My name is Cyrus Farmer, and you are watching and listening to the Stomp the Tea podcast. Folks, we have so much to get into tonight, so I'm actually going to kind of cut to the quick, as they say, and we can just jump right into the show. What are we talking about tonight? We're going to be talking about the latest match in the TGL. The Tiger Woods, Rory McIlroy inspired lead. The actual two co-founders went head to head this past week, and it was a fascinating match. I have some thoughts on that. We'll also be reviewing the NFC and AFC championship games, folks. Two interesting games that decided the two participants in this year's Super Bowl. And I'm going to be telling you at least five reasons why you should be incredibly excited about this Super Bowl and why you should love the game. I mean, the game is, I think, going to be tremendous. And I'm going to give you a couple of reasons why that will be the case. And of course, everyone's favorite segment, what are you drinking tonight? So without further ado, TGL. Folks, this is what I have to say about the latest match that was televised of the TGL. Finally, a close match. I mean, guys, this match between Tiger's Jupiter Links Golf Club and Rory's Boston Commons Golf Club was a very, very good watch. It was, in my opinion, scintillating. It was really, really like the first time you kind of felt not only competitive juices for the golfers flowing, but as an audience member, there were times when I was watching, and again, I did not watch the entire match. I'm going to go back and look at the entire match just to see if that tension sustains, but obviously it builds. But I have to say, it was like the first time I've watched TGL and I either sat back or my jaw dropped or I was like, oh, at some of the things that happened. It was a wonderful experience. If you have not seen the TGL yet, it's worth checking out. If you have not seen the TGL latest match, match four between Tiger and Rory, it is completely worth checking out. Folks, do yourself a favor. I'm going to give you some numbers. Now, the viewership for the fourth edition of the TGL between Tiger and Rory, the numbers, preliminary numbers are there were 864,000 viewers. And viewership peaked at 1,082,000 viewers. And that was from 8:30 p.m. to 8:45 p.m. I got to tell you, it really was compelling. This is going to sound crazy. It really was compelling simulated golf. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to even say it out loud. But I have to be honest. It was completely, I mean, you saw what the TGL could be all in that match between Tiger and Rory. I mean, Tiger had a shot clock violation. And let me tell you, the shot clock, that is an innovation that I could see coming to the PGA Tour, or at least one of the majors, sometime between now and the end of the decade. I'm telling you, the shot clock, especially if you have more displays of slow play like you had at Torrey Pines this past weekend. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, that was a disaster from what I understand. It was genuinely fun and compelling to watch. One of the most interesting aspects of the TGL is that the players, you know, they take and make and execute these shots all with music in the background. We've mentioned this before. The crowd, you know, being able to cheer, boo, talk. Basically, It's golf, indoor simulated golf, granted. But it is golf that is not being played in an outdoor church setting. It is fascinating, and it really makes you wonder if golf, as far as an innovation is concerned, if golf is going to kind of evolve into some of the other major sports where it's not all hushed tones and everyone be quiet. I prefer, personally, a little decorum myself when I am watching golf live on a course at an event. But to be fair, these players seem to be executing more or less with or without crowd noise. So it, to me, it just tells you they have the capability of doing that, possibly, outside. So the golf is more like baseball, football, basketball, and the fans don't have to speak in whispered tones while a golfer is over his approach shot to the 13th green. It's been fascinating. I mean, again, watch TGL, and you'll see how much noise is taking place during these golfers' not only routine to set up, but also when they're taking their shots. And why do the golfers march forward and ignore and block out all that noise? Because there is a shot clock, and they do not want a violation. It is fascinating. This TGL, it could really kind of change the face of golf 5-6 years from now. You watch. It'd be interesting. It's weird because this was such a competitive match. So, you know, we talk about the noise and we talk about the crowd not necessarily being whispering to one another while these players are taking the shots. But in the biggest moments, the crowd hushed themselves. It wasn't completely silent. You know, there was still music in the background. It's not like you could hear a pin drop. Like there was no talking amongst the crowd. But they policed and hushed themselves. Why? Because of the anticipation, the suspense about what was going to or not going to happen preceding the next shot or the next putt. It was fascinating. Folks, I cannot recommend it. You don't even have to watch the whole match between Tiger and Roy. I haven't watched the whole match yet. I will, but I haven't. All you need to do is turn on like the last 3 or 4 holes of the singles, and you will see genuine tension there and suspense among not only the players, but also the people watching in the crowd, in the audience. I think it was a huge, huge win. Now, if you look at their ratings in general, over 4 matches, the TGL has averaged around 874,000 viewers per match. Now, those numbers are going to go down as they hurtle towards the end of their season. TGL is only around for like another 5 or 6 weeks, tops. Next week, they're going to have like a triple header, I think, during President's Day. So it'll be interesting to see what the numbers are, not only on those matches, but it will also be interesting to see what the level of competition is. And if they can replicate any of those 3 matches, can replicate the competitiveness of what just happened on Monday with Tiger and Rory. You know, one of the things that was interesting, you actually saw during this 4th match, you actually saw players eyeing their shots, even though it was on a simulator. What do I mean when I say eyeing their shots? They would swing and hit the shot, and literally they would look at the ball on the simulator, look down at the simulator hole, then look back up to their ball as it flew simulated flight on a 5-story screen and landed on a simulated green or fairway or bunker or water. It was awesome. It was absolutely awesome. This is the most, to me, the TGL has felt like real golf since its inception. And again, I think the potential is through the roof. If they can get players to buy in, and if they can cut out, again, if they can cut out the need in their mind to have the Matt Barry, who I have nothing against, I think he does a fine job, the play-by-play interaction with the golfers. We don't need that interaction. There were a couple times Matt Barry asked Tiger a question, and because of the competitive nature of this week's match, Tiger just ignored it. He pretended like he didn't hear at all. He was focused on what he was doing, whether it was hitting his shot or whether it was giving advice to teammates during their shots. He completely blocked it out, like he didn't hear what the play-by-play announcer asked at all. And I think that's probably the right way to approach it. We don't need play-by-play members asking the golfers questions. Leave that to Marty Smith when he interviews them, all right? Otherwise, just keep the mic open. Let us hear what these players have to say amongst themselves and to each other. And there was some good-natured ribbing going on. Tom Kim was all in as far as personality display. It reminded me a little bit of Billy Horschel. But that's sometimes what something like the TGL needs. They need to kind of have these heightened versions of their own personality that come off a little bit more authentic and less forced. So, I mean, Tom Kim, he did the job this week. It was awesome. It was definitely interesting. And folks, it's completely worth watching. Now, before we go any further, I want to remind you, don't forget to like, don't forget to subscribe, tell your friends, tell your enemies, do everything that you would do to support any kind of show or endeavor that you yourself personally enjoy. We are going to be continuing to bring you content here, and that is going to happen on a weekly basis, so you can count on us. But that being said, we have an audio version, obviously, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. You can find us there. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on all the socials. So do not forget to spread the word about Stomp the Tee, your favorite little podcast, the little engine that could. All right, so let's get into these championship game reviews. And we're going to take them in order, not because I'm an Eagles fan, but because the Eagles and Commanders played first. All right. The NFC Championship game. First thoughts that came to mind while I was watching and afterward. Two words. Domination and Saquon. Folks, it was amazing to watch the Eagles clicking, you know, on all cylinders in all three phases of the game. Offense, defense, special teams. This team, this Eagles team, put on a genuinely impressive display. Now, going into the game, I have to admit, I thought that Washington would play well. But I did think that the Eagle talent eventually would push Washington off the stage, which is exactly what ended up happening. But that being said, I did not expect the Eagles to play as well as they did, again, in all three phases of the game, offense, defense, special teams. It was utter domination. I've heard a lot of people talk about, the Eagles put up 55 points, but without the turnovers, the game would have been closer. Well, yeah. I mean, that's a given, but turnovers are part of football games. They're a part of most sports. I don't think you can have a turnover in baseball, but you can't have turnovers in basketball. The Eagles scored 28 points off of 4 turnovers in the NFC Championship game. You literally cannot get more efficient than that. I mean, they were tremendous in the game. And I don't understand why you would eliminate the turnovers. The Eagles caused those turnovers. So yes, the score was what it was because in part of the turnovers, and the other part of it was that the Eagles were that good. Now, I will say, in my opinion, the game definitely got a little chippy, just like the last game at the end of December played in Washington between the Eagles and the Commanders. And I'm telling you right now, if the Commanders are trying to replace the Dallas Cowboys as public enemy number one in the Philadelphia Eagle fan lexicon's mind, they are off to a pretty good start. It was a very chippy game. And look, I think Frankie Louvu is a really, really solid player. He had a very, very good year. But, you know, if you guys want to turn this into cheap shots and dirty plays, the Eagles will be happy to oblige over the next 5, 6, 7, 10 years. But I have to say, it definitely was exciting to me that this I-95 going south for the Eagles, division foe, could turn into a genuine rival. I mean, literally, even more so than the Giants historically have been for the Eagles. Washington, Philadelphia, they are not that far from each other. Further away from Philadelphia and New York, but still, all within 4 hours. No one gets on a plane when we play each other, as far as the Washington team and the Philadelphia Eagles. So, and Washington is going to be good for a very long time, I believe. But the same is true of the Eagles. And if they want to make this some kind of blood feud rivalry, the Eagles will be more than happy to oblige. I mean, it was very stark to me how chippy the game got from early on. And they seem to genuinely have dislike for each other that has grown and developed. Now, it'll be interesting because the Eagles, they are very balanced on offense. That defense can make plays at every single level. You saw that during the NFC Championship game. I mean, Washington hung in there to their credit. And I will say this. I personally did not feel like the game was out of reach for Washington until the Eagles got a 3-score lead. I mean, anything, you know, 14, 16 points or less, I felt like Washington still was completely in the game. And that's a team now. Who knows if they can replicate what happened this year moving forward. But my suspicion is they're going to be very good, and they're only going to get better. They have cap room. They have drafts coming up. They're going to be able to replace some of their aging players with younger players. I think Washington is going to be here for a while. And, of course, as we all know, so will the Eagles. You know, I want to make a mention here about the broadcast. Tom Brady, whom I haven't listened to or watched a lot of the games that he's broadcast for Fox this season, but I will say this. I thought he was very, very good on the game. I mean, he made some excellent points when he talked about Jalen Hurts holding the ball, right? He essentially was talking about sometimes Jalen tends to hold on to the ball waiting for something else to develop. And Tom's point was that receivers get open. When they get open, they usually get open early. So let it go. Let it go when they're open. He made this great, great point, which I thought was probably the best thing he said all day. And essentially he's like, when you hold the ball for 4 seconds or longer, which Jalen has had a tendency to do, he said, things generally don't get better. Which, you know, I thought it was wonderful analysis. You know, get the ball out of your hands. sometimes take a shot when they're one-on-one. And the best thing about Brady, I think, in this particular game, NFC Championship game, was that he was critical without being negative. And also without catering to, you know, trying to be buddies with players. Now, who knows what he's going to be like or when he talks about Mahomes in the Super Bowl in a week and a half. But I thought he was fantastic in the game, especially with his critique of Hurts. I thought it was really, really good. And I thought it was fair, which was awesome. You know, we all like fairness. Let's see, what else do I have here? There were too many errors and bad decisions by Washington on both sides of the ball in the first half. The Eagles, they just had too much talent for the Commanders. And I will say this, it was an awesome, gutty, and impressive performance by the Eagles' offensive line as a whole, but in particular, Landon Dickerson and Cam Jurgens. Folks, Cam Jurgens, the Eagles, I believe both Cam Jurgens and Landon Dickerson are both all pros this season at their respective positions. I don't know if they're first, second, or third team all pros, but I think they're both all pros. And Cam Jurgens did not start the game because he had back issues. So Landon Dickerson moved over from left guard to play center, and they put Tyler Steen in there to play left guard. Now, Dickerson played well, but in the first quarter, he ends up getting hurt. We don't know what the injury was, knee or something. But Dickerson continued to play, and he gutted it out until Jurgens, who was not eliminated for the game. He was just doubtful, and he was dressed, but he wasn't going to play until Dickerson got hurt. And Jurgens then put his helmet on, bad back and all, and completed the rest of the game. I think it was from like middle second quarter on to the end of the game. Just a tremendous display by both men of genuine toughness, grit, ability. It was very, very, very impressive. And that's why, you know, so many people say that the Eagles have the best offensive line in football. That was an example of not only how good they are, but how gritty they are. All right. As we know, Washington has a bright future, but it wasn't their day Sunday. But I will say this. I thought that the tush push with Frankie Louvu jumping over the top and all the things that occurred, I think the tush push's days are numbered. I think that the NFL are going to do everything they can, whether it's competition committee or, Commissioner Goodell, whomever makes those decisions. I think they are about ready to get rid of the tush push. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to it in the offseason. But, you know, you can't have defenders jumping over the top to stop the tush push against the Eagles 3, 4, 5 plays in a row. I mean, it kind of, at a certain point, it becomes a mockery. And it's not necessarily good for the game. Now, obviously, the quarterback sneak will stay in the game. It's been in the game for a long time. But I think they're going to ban players from assisting whoever the ball carrier is. You know, Baltimore has a very good tush push as well that's run by Mark Andrews instead of Lamar Jackson. So I think they're going to ban or eliminate the assistance that can be given by pushing a player who has the ball. So we'll see. The AFC Championship game, folks. There is one place and one place only to start with this game, and that is at the beginning. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to read this so I get it correct. Retired Petty Officer First Class Gerald Wilson sang the best national anthem of the 2025 postseason, in my opinion. It was one of the best national anthems I've heard in years. Boy, was he good. Folks, if you have not heard the national anthem that Petty Officer General Wilson sang, look it up on YouTube. It is completely worth your time. Now, I happen to be a sucker for the national anthem. Any big event, sporting or otherwise, where the national anthem is sung, I always try to tune in and listen if it is being covered on television, because it's a tough song to sing, and it's the kind of song that when you give a great rendition of, it stands out. You don't have to wonder, was that good or not? No, you know when someone sings a good national anthem from the United States of America. And I'm a huge, huge fan of the national anthem. And also, side note, America the Beautiful. Slightly underrated song, in my opinion. But it's also a song you can do a lot with. Great versions abound of America the Beautiful. And I'm glad that so many sporting events have started including America the Beautiful along with the national anthem to kick off their events. Now, I will say this, you know, there have been several renditions of the national anthem this postseason that I thought were all very good, very solid. A lot of Broadway stars and a lot of Broadway singers have sung these versions. And I think for the most part, they've all done a very good job. But retired Petty Officer First Class General Wilson completely takes the cake. And just on a side note, I will say, I used to always love Marvin Gaye's version of the national anthem. He sang it at the 1983 NBA All-Star Game. And it was completely different from any version you've ever heard. If you haven't heard it, you should look it up on YouTube. It's really nice. And we all, of course, remember Whitney Houston's 1991 version, which to this point is still the standard for any national anthem sung anywhere. Okay, on to the game. Folks, Buffalo to me seemed out of sorts early, and I think they just needed to run the ball really from the very outset of the game, early and often. For some reason, you know, even though they settled down, for some reason, I believe they got away from what got them there, which was leaning heavily on their run game with James Cook. And I forget the other running back. I think he's 26. I think he's a rookie. I forget his name, but lean on the run game if you're the Buffalo Bills. This is what got you there. And all of a sudden, you're going to start being pass happy in Kansas City in the AFC Championship game when you haven't done that all season successfully. I just thought it was weird. It was like Buffalo was trying to prove a point, in my opinion. Excuse me. I don't know if it was Sean McDermott, it was Joe Brady, it was Josh Allen, whatever. It's like they were trying to prove a point that, you know, our quarterback is either truly an MVP or is better than or as good as Mahomes or whatever, instead of going with what got them there, which was running the ball, letting Allen make his throws here and there to distribute the ball, and let Josh Allen run when needed, very successfully. It just felt like they kind of got distracted by the magnitude of the game, in my opinion. I'm going to give you an example of what I'm talking about with Buffalo. The fact that the Bills didn't lean on their run game with there was 3 minutes and 35 seconds left in the game. In the fourth quarter, they were down, the Bills. They were down 3 points, but they had two timeouts. The fact that they didn't lean on their run game completely was astounding to me. I mean, they literally had the ability to run out the entire clock and score either a field goal or to tie or a touchdown to win. And James Cook, their outstanding back, he did not touch the ball during their final drive. Can you explain that to me? And this is after Cook went crazy in the third quarter. I think he scored 2 touchdowns in the third quarter. This is a man, James Cook, who scored 18 touchdowns during the course of a year. How do you forget about him? How do you not use him, especially when you need him most? 3 minutes, 35 seconds left, only down 3 with 2 timeouts at the end of the game. Cook had 13 rushes for the game. Now, he also caught 3 passes for 49 yards. You're going to tell me James Cook was worn out? I mean, how, when you have a chance to go to the Super Bowl, do you not use this weapon you've used all year? I didn't understand it. Folks, I didn't understand it one bit. It was very, very strange to me. And the Bills completely mismanaged the game. So it was weird. You know, the Bills, in a weird way, they're kind of like the opposite, at least in the AFC Championship game. They were kind of like the opposite of the Eagles in that the Eagles, and you've seen it all season, they do not care how they win games. I've said it before for the last couple of years. How do you want it, right? The Eagles can win games with the pass, with the run, with defense. They can win games from week to week different ways. And they don't care how they win as long as they win. Now, the Bills, they seemed really, really, again, this is just my opinion, they seemed really, really set on passing their way into the Super Bowl when that was not necessary as far as I was concerned. Can we talk, speaking of passing, about the final play of the Bills on offense in that game? We all know that Steve Spagnuolo drew up a great blitz, and Josh Allen ends up throwing this ball, which has become, in my mind, kind of a mythology that didn't actually take place. Josh throws the ball in the air, and it ends up, the ball, in the area of the Bills tight end, Dalton Kincaid. Now, subsequently, so many commentators have given Josh Allen credit for, you know, turns out it was a great play by Allen. He, you know, he spotted Kincaid, and that's where he was getting the ball. I don't think that happened at all. I don't know that for a fact. I'm just giving you my opinion. I thought Josh was under so much heat, he was just throwing the ball up for grabs. Now, nothing wrong with that. Give yourself and your team a chance. But I don't think Josh spotted Dalton Kincaid and said, oh, let me get it in his direction. Let me throw this before I get sacked. Fourth down. No, I think he was just throwing the ball up for grabs. That's number one. Number two, Dalton Kincaid, for anyone, and I've heard it several times, who would call the lack of securing the ball by Dalton Kincaid a drop is out of their minds. Out of their minds. I mean, this was a frenetic play on fourth down. The fact that Dalton Kincaid didn't secure the catch doesn't mean that he dropped it. It just means he didn't make an amazing play. If Dalton Kincaid had caught that ball, it wouldn't have been one of the top 20 postseason playoff plays in the history of the National Football League. It would have been a big, 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 big deal play, especially if the Bills went on to win the game. But I keep hearing versions of, well, Kincaid's got to catch that ball. Kincaid's got to catch that ball. Why? It was an incredibly difficult catch to make, in my opinion. It's not like he was literally sitting there and he was wide open and there was no traffic around him and the ball came to him cleanly. No, that literally wasn't the case. Look, you got to be honest. We all saw the replay of how close Dalton Kincaid was to making that catch. But did you think Kincaid, quote unquote, dropped that pass when you were watching it live? When you're watching it in real time? Absolutely not. It would have been an incredible, incredible catch. But to say Kincaid has to make that catch, no. I mean, would you have said when you saw the play that David Tyree made against the Patriots, when Eli escaped the sack, threw the ball up for grabs, in my opinion as well, towards David Tyree's direction, and Tyree makes the helmet catch. If he had dropped the ball with Rodney Harrison pulling on his arm, would you have said, oh, that's got to be a catch that Tyree makes. Tyree's got to make that catch. When Santonio Holmes made the wonderful, extended, toe-touching grab in the Super Bowl to win the game against Arizona from Ben Roethlisberger, if somehow Santonio Holmes wasn't able to get both feet down, would you have said, oh, Santonio Holmes got to make that catch? That's a catch he has to make. Roethlisberger put the ball the only place he could. Yes, it was extended, but Santonio Holmes got to get both feet down and make that catch. No, you would not have said that. Why? Because it was an incredible play, an incredible catch. That's what makes great plays great. Would you have said, if you were watching live, the game between the Oakland Raiders and the Pittsburgh Steelers, the immaculate reception, that after the deflection, Franco Harris scoops the ball out of midair, and the ball almost touches the ground, but he gets his hand underneath it, runs for the touchdown to win the game. Would you have said if Franco doesn't catch that ball, if it actually hits the ground, would you have said, look, that's a catch Franco has to make? No, you would not have said that, because by definition, great plays are great. They are not ordinary. So I don't want to hear anything about Dalton Kincaid dropping the ball or not making a catch he has to make. None of that is true as far as I'm concerned. He did what he could in real time, and he could not secure the ball. That is not a crime. No one said it was, to be fair. But stop painting this picture of Dalton Kincaid not making a play he has to make because of the magnitude of the moment. He did the best he could. And if he'd made the play, it would have been an all-time great play. So, leave Dalton Kincaid alone. Let's see. What else do I have here? You know, I thought Josh Allen was solid, but he wasn't good enough to help his team over the hump. You know, it was strange. Josh Allen rarely plays poorly in these games, and he's done a much better job of not turning the ball over the last couple of years, which makes a big difference. But at the end of the day, if you're Josh Allen, you have to find a way to get your team over the hump, regardless of how much or how little help you are getting from the rest of your team and or coaching staff. I think if the Bills had done what they'd done all year, and lean on the running game and let Josh make plays here and there, they probably would be playing in the Super Bowl in a week and a half. For whatever reason, they decided to diverge from that. And once again, Josh Allen is on the outside looking in. It's not completely his fault. But if you're going to be Josh Allen, you have to find a way to get your team over the hump. That's, strangely enough, what we take for granted about Patrick Mahomes. And Patrick Mahomes always finds a way, it seems, to get his team over the hump. And as good as Patrick Mahomes is, the fact that he finds a way is noteworthy, because we can see Josh Allen has not been able to do that. We can see Lamar Jackson has not been able to do that. We can see that Joe Burrow can't even get into the playoffs every year. When he gets there, he's usually pretty good, but he can't even get to the playoffs every season. So let's not take what Patrick Mahomes does for granted, folks. You're watching a very, very special player. Okay, speaking of special players, I do want to talk about the five reasons you should love this matchup in the Super Bowl coming up in a week and a half. Now, let me start off with a couple things. I have to say, a lot of the voices you hear talking about, Eagles and Chiefs, this was a matchup I didn't want to see. Anyone other than the Eagles and the Chiefs, it would have been better. I don't think that's the majority of football fans. I think the majority of football fans are looking forward to this game. The majority of football fans are actually anticipating what's going to happen in this game. Remember, the game 2 years ago was a very, very good game. And regardless of how you feel about the Chiefs and being chiefed out, as they say, or rooting against Goliath, as Wilt Chamberlain used to say, no one roots for Goliath. Or how you feel about the Philadelphia Eagles and, more importantly, their fan base, which we'll talk about in a moment. This is going to be a fantastic game. It really, I have no doubt that it is going to be a fantastic game. And we'll get into the whys and the wherefores next week. But I think this game is going to be very, very competitive. And I think it's going to be a fascinating watch, more importantly. So the loudest voices in the room sometimes make you feel like no one wants to see this matchup. But I, for one, definitely wanted to see this matchup. And I know for a fact that I am not alone. I don't know how many more people outside of me wanted to see this matchup. But I know I wanted to see it, and I think that most football fans will be very pleased by the matchup that is actually going to be taking place. Now, let me get something on the table, and I think it should be addressed. The Philadelphia Eagle fan base is a problem. It's true. Some, certainly not all, but a significant portion of the Philadelphia Eagle fan base, not just Philadelphia Eagles, Philadelphia, of any Philadelphia sports teams, there's a significant portion of that fan base that are just assholes. Let's be fair about it. I mean, I don't know. When I say significant portion, what do I mean? Is it 3%, 12%, 14%, 33%, 41%? Who knows? I know it's less than a majority, and I also, I'm pretty sure that it's more than 10%. So, I mean, it kind of is what it is. And I'll put it this way. Is it right for any fan of their team to be harassed because they choose to wear their team's gear when they're playing the Eagles, either at home or on the road? No, absolutely not. Is it fair that you're not able to root vocally for your team, especially in Philadelphia, if that team is not the Philadelphia Eagles, in fear of Eagles fans abusing you verbally or physically? Absolutely not. Do I condone, me, Cyrus Farmer, personally, the bad behavior and the incidents that have occurred of Philadelphia fans? Absolutely not. Not at all. Of course not. But this is how Philadelphia fans are. And I'm telling you right now, I recorded a video right after the NFC Championship game in which I warned New Orleans to hide the women and the children. And I'm telling you, Most of what you've heard about Philadelphia fans, if you're not familiar with Philadelphia fans, most of what you've heard is true. So that video wasn't an Eagle fan reveling in the fact that his team is returning to the Super Bowl again, and look out, New Orleans, here we come to the Super Bowl. No. That video I posted, it was a public service announcement. New Orleans, you have been warned. I'm just telling you right now. An Eagles victory coupled with the city of New Orleans, coupled again with Eagle fans intoxicated and full of revelry after the game, is a recipe for mayhem. Now, is anything bad going to happen? I don't think so, but I'm telling you right now, Philadelphia fans can be intolerable in a number of different ways, especially when we win. So, New Orleans, you have been warned. Now, I'm going to give you the five reasons that I think this game is a game you should love if you're a football fan. Number one, the coaching matchups. Folks, you have Steve Spagnuolo versus Kellen Moore, Andy Reid versus Vic Fangio. Now, much like the Week 18 matchup, and we talked about this a couple episodes ago, between the Lions and the Vikings, it's going to be fascinating to see which of these staffs, end up gaining the upper hand, not only at the start of the game, but throughout the game, and certainly at the end of the game. I mean, is Fangio going to be forced to blitz more than he normally does? He's been playing a lot of zone for the vast majority of the game. Is Mahomes and Reed going to kind of get him out of there because Mahomes checks to runs, or Mahomes runs the ball himself? Are they going to make Fangio blitz a little more often than he's comfortable with? And we all know how good Mahomes can be against the blitz. How will Spagnuolo stop the Eagles' running game? I mean, can the Kansas City O-line, can they give Mahomes enough time to get the ball downfield against that Eagles front four? I mean, there are so many definitely little things and big things that are going to be so much fun to watch from a coaching aspect. I mean, how will Spagnuolo disguise what he's doing? And will Hurts be able to pick up those disguises, unveil them? Reason number two, Saquon Barkley. Folks, after witnessing one of the greatest seasons we've ever seen from a running back, will Kansas City go all in stopping Saquon Barkley, even at the cost of leaving their defensive backs one-on-one or in man versus the Eagle receivers and playmakers? I mean, that's a dangerous game you're playing. You may not like Jalen Hurts as a quarterback, but Jalen Hurts can hit receivers. I've seen him do it. He may not do it 9 times out of 10, but he can definitely do it 7.5 times out of 10. And if you leave A.J. Brown, Devontae Smith, Dallas Goedert, even who's the kid from Washington that they picked up? I forget his name, but you know who I'm talking about. Anyway, Jalen can hit these guys. I've seen him do it. So, you know, if you're going to play that game, be careful. You know, will the Philadelphia offensive line even allow Saquon, especially if Jalen Hurts runs early and often? Will the offensive line of Philadelphia even allow Saquon to be shut down? I just think there's so many fascinating possibilities on this. Reason number three, three-peat versus get back / revenge. Both teams acted like they had another game to play after they won their championship games, and both should be hyper-focused on winning the game. They both have a lot to play for. There will certainly be a lack of intimidation for the Eagles when it comes to playing the Kansas City Chiefs. They played very well in the Super Bowl a couple of years ago. They beat Kansas City in the regular season last year. Philadelphia is not going to be intimidated at all by whatever the Chiefs do. Obviously, the same can be said for the Chiefs versus the Eagles. I mean, you're talking about a two-time defending champ. They're not going to be intimidated by anyone. They might not win every game, but they're certainly not going to be intimidated by the Eagles, no matter how good they are, and no matter how good that Eagle defense is. Reason number four, Chris Jones versus Jalen Carter. Who will have the bigger impact on the game? Now, Chris Jones has been so good during this Kansas City run, and in some ways, he's kind of like the unheralded, in my opinion, the unheralded biggest piece of the puzzle. We all talk Mahomes. We all talk Kelce. We talked, especially during the first run, about Tyreek Hill. We talk about Harrison Butker, right? We talk about Chris Jones on the defense without question. We talk about Steve Spagnuolo. But Chris Jones may be the second or third most important piece to Kansas City's ability to win the games and Super Bowls and championships they've won. I mean, you have to include Andy Reid. You have to include Patrick Mahomes. You have to include Steve Spagnuolo. You have to include Travis Kelce. But Jones might fall third on that list behind Reid and Mahomes, or reverse it, Mahomes and Reid, whatever. He's been that good. He's made that many plays. Now, Jalen Carter, we've watched him grow up before our very eyes. He's grown. He's matured. He's developed in his second year into one of the best, if not the best, interior defensive linemen in all of football. He's a fantastic defensive tackle. They both have the ability to wreck games. They both made big plays this postseason. Who is going to make the bigger play more consistently in this Super Bowl? I think that is actually going to be a fascinating, fascinating, fascinating matchup. And the fifth and final reason you should love this game. Will Jalen Hurts rise to the occasion again? Folks, let me tell you. I've told you this before, and I'm going to say it again. Jalen Hurts should have been, in my opinion, the MVP of the Super Bowl 2 years ago. Even though he lost, he was that good in the game. He was better than Mahomes was in the game, and Mahomes won. And Mahomes won the MVP, I believe, of that game as well. I'm telling you this. Jalen Hurts, all he's done, all he's ever done, his whole life is face challenge after challenge, and meet them with varying degrees of success. Now, he's found himself, there were exceptions to the level of success he's had, right? But he's found himself in playoffs year after year after year, championship games year after year after year, Super Bowls, two now in 3 years. He always winds up in these games, and he doesn't win them all. Nobody does. No one bats 1,000. But on and off, by and large, he has played well in these big games. And I'm going to tell you something else. If the Eagles win the Super Bowl, you can start the clock right now. The second after the clock expires on the Super Bowl, on whether or not Jalen Hurts will win multiple Super Bowls. I'm telling you right now. All the guy does is win games. And all the guy does is put himself and his teams in these positions to win games. It's easy to take Jalen Hurts for granted, but I'm telling you, if he can find a way to win this Super Bowl, he may actually do two things. Number one, he may actually surpass Mahomes in total Super Bowl wins by the time it's all said and done. The Eagles aren't going anywhere. they're going to be good for a long time. And Jalen's only going to get better, especially if he can ever have the same offensive coordinator more than a couple years in a row, which it looks like he's about to lose another one. We talked about this a few weeks ago as well, because Kellen Moore is probably going to take the job in New Orleans. He's probably going to get offered and take the job in New Orleans. So offensive coordinator number five is on the way for Jalen Hurts in 6 years. Crazy. But number one, he may actually catch and surpass Mahomes as far as total titles are concerned. But number two, if, and this is a big if the Eagles can find a way to win the Super Bowl in a week and a half, Jalen Hurts will play a starring role in the denial, possibly, of Mahomes ever catching Brady. I mean, you're going to talk about an instant rivalry that most people would not consider the two quarterbacks on the same level, Patrick Mahomes and Jalen Hurts. But if they go 1-1 in Super Bowls in 3 years, there is a chance that they will meet again for a third Super Bowl, maybe even a fourth Super Bowl at some point. I'm telling you, this is something to watch. Can Jalen Hurts answer the bell? Now, Jalen's lack of consistency to this point in his career kind of obscures the fact that all he does is win games. He's a winner. And historically, he's performed well in these big games. Winning the Super Bowl will definitely change the narrative on Jalen Hurts. We don't know to what degree yet, but it will change the narrative. So, there's that. Now, folks, as much fun as I've had talking football and TGL golf with you, I do have a question for you. What are you drinking tonight? Well, I can tell you exactly what I'm drinking tonight. And that is Stellum Rye. Folks, I'm going to give you some information, I'm going to give you some numbers, and I'm going to tell you what I think about it. This Stellum Rye is bottled by Stellum Spirits in Louisville, Kentucky. It is distilled in Indiana, Kentucky, and Tennessee. Okay, what does that mean? Well, I'll tell you. Most of what is in this bottle is 95% Indiana rye, presumably distilled by MGP. We don't know that, but they do a lot of this kind of stuff. So the other 5% is barley forward rye from select barrels in Kentucky and Tennessee. Now, there is no age statement, but you know, this juice is rumored to be around 4 to 6 years old, and who knows for sure, but those are the rumors. Now, Stellum Rye is brought to you by the people who bring you Barrel Bourbon. I've had Barrel. I've tried a couple of their offerings. Their company is actually called Barrel Craft Spirits. And I got this bottle, this Stellum Rye. I myself got it for $50 for the bottle. Now, this comes in, this, show you the bottle again, this Stellum Rye. It comes in at 58.12% ABV. That's ABV, obviously, stands for alcohol by volume, which makes it 116.24 proof. A big, bold, high-proof rye. Now, it was launched by Barrel Craft Spirits in 2021. Stellum, as a label, they lean heavily into modernity and the science of whiskey making. Stellum is a derivative of Stella, which is the Latin word for star. Now, Stellum's founder, Joe Beatrice, he said, and I want to read this so I get it right. He said, "We wanted to create a brand that brings American whiskey into the modern age with simple, elegant blends and single barrels selected with care and attention. Now, as you can see from the bottom, the packaging is minimum, and that is minimal. And that is by design. And I have to say, I was initially resistant to Stellum because I didn't know a whole lot about them. And I got to be honest, the packaging, it seemed a little stark for my taste, which, to their credit, mission accomplished as far as being minimalist and leaning towards modernity. Now, all that being said, I am genuinely surprised by the results of their efforts. Folks, this Stellum Rye, and I got to tell you, it makes me want to try their bourbon now. It is pretty good. It's pretty good. I mean, you know what it reminds me of? And this is, it's not a one-to-one, but as far as drinkability, now it's at a higher price point, but $50 a bottle is not going to break anybody that we know. It reminds me, drinkability-wise, of Elijah Craig. Now, this Stellum Rye is actually a little spicy, but in a savory way, but also with notes of sweetness. It's really, really, you can drink it neat, and it's not going to hurt you. Again, why does Cyrus Farmer gravitate towards higher proof whiskeys? Why? Because if you can drink it straight, if you can drink it neat, with or without water, and it doesn't burn, that is true, genuine distillation craftsmanship. And that's what I appreciate above me on anything else. Flavor, of course, has to come into the equation without question. But they did a really, really good job with this wonderful Stellum Rye. I'm going to tell you, folks, I would recommend it. And a side note, you know, either last week or 2 weeks ago, it was one of the two, we gave a nod to Detroit and talked about the Mayor Pingree Red Label, which I was not a huge fan of. Neat. But, folks, I got to tell you, I had the rest of it in highball form. Highball, obviously, it's we talked about this before. It's a big Japanese cocktail. It's basically the national drink of Japan, which is whiskey and soda, essentially, on ice. Boy, that Pingree, that Mayor Pingree, in a highball form was very, very drinkable. And that's what I want to relay to you guys. Folks, remember, if you buy a bottle, I don't care whether it costs $12 or $200, and you're not in love with it, there's still something you can do with it. Turn it into a cocktail bottle. Turn it into a mixer bottle. But the only thing lacking in making a bottle you're not in love with, a bottle you become a fan of, is your own imagination. Think about how to use it. It's not necessarily the end of the world, but you can use it one way or another, whether it's a simple mixer, again, highball, whiskey soda, or, you know, make it a Manhattan bottle, make it in a cocktail bottle, whatever. Or it's good enough to drink neat, or it's good enough to drink on the rocks. Use whatever you buy because you bought it already. So you might as well use it. All right, folks. That is tonight's show. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. We will be back here next week, as always. And we want to thank you for tuning in. My name is Cyrus Farmer. This is the Stomp the Tea podcast. We will continue to bring you content. And as always, we'll see you on the first tee.